June 23rd, 1996, Boston, Massachusetts. The dismembered upper body of 20-year-old Karina Homer is found inside a plastic bag in a dumpster. She was strangled to death before being sliced directly in half, and the lower portion of her body is never recovered. Karina hails from Sweden and has spent the past 3 months working as an au pair for a married couple, and she was last seen partying at a nightclub nearly 36 hours before she was found. Even though the investigation looks at a number of potential suspects, there is no evidence to implicate anyone, so the crime remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be covering one of the more brutal unsolved crimes of the modern era, the 1996 murder of Karina Homer. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Anil Adyanthaya, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Anil. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for 5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the murder of Karina Homer was the case that Anil suggested I cover when he originally entered this contest, and since he is not the only listener who has suggested it, I thought now would be a good time for an episode. This case has often been compared to the unsolved 1947 murder of Elizabeth Short, aka the Black Dolly murder, since both crimes involved a young female victim having their bodies literally sliced in half at the waist. Karina Homer hailed from a small village in Sweden and traveled to the United States in order to work as an au pair for a family who lived in a suburb of Boston. One night, Karina decided to go to a downtown nightclub with her friends, but she became separated from them and would not be seen until nearly 36 hours later, when the upper half of her dismembered body was discovered inside a plastic trash bag in a dumpster. One of the most frustrating aspects of the investigation is that there were contradictory eyewitness accounts about the circumstances of how Karina left the nightclub, and it's unclear if she was alone or in the company of someone who may have been her killer. What further complicates things is that Karina had written letters to her family and friends in Sweden in which she expressed unhappiness with her situation and seemed anxious to return home. In fact, she told one friend that, quote-unquote, something terrible had happened, but never revealed what she was referring to, and we have no idea if this has any possible connection to her death. Investigators went on to uncover a couple of potential suspects, but no conclusive evidence to link any of them to the crime. So on this episode, we're going to try and figure out why Karina became the victim of such a sadistic murder. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that near the end of December, our podcast is going to be releasing another special Q&A episode, so if you have a question you would like to hear answered on the show, please email it to me under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is Sunday, December the 11th. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Karina Homer.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Massachusetts in 1996. Our central figure is 20-year-old Carina Holmer, who hails from Ullared, Sweden, a small farming village of less than 100 people, which is located over 375 kilometers southwest of the capital city of Stockholm. Carina grew up there with her parents and three sisters, but had an adventurous spirit and hoped to own or manage a restaurant someday. Carina received a major break when she won 10,000 krona on a scratch ticket in the Swedish state lottery, which was the equivalent of 1,500 American dollars at that time, and decided that she would use this money to finance a trip to the United States. Carina's older sister, Johanna, had previous experience working as an au pair, a job which involves traveling to a foreign country to provide childcare and housework for a host family in exchange for room and board and a weekly stipend. Since Carina wanted to follow in her sister's footsteps, she contacted an au pair agency that specialized in U.S. placements and wound up receiving a job with an American family. The couple in question were Frank Rapp, a 49-year-old commercial photographer, and his wife, Susan Nichter, a 37-year-old artist, who had a 6-year-old son and a daughter who was still a toddler. The family lived in a condominium complex in the wealthy, upscale suburb of Dover, located about 15 miles southwest of downtown Boston. Carina accepted the position and left for the United States in March, but before she boarded her plane at the airport, the last words she said to her family were, quote, "I hope I'm doing the right thing." While Carina would spend the week living in a spare room in the family's condo, Frank Rapp gave her the keys to his photography studio, which was located in the Fort Point neighborhood of South Boston and doubled as a loft. Carina would spend her weekends there, and this gave her the opportunity to explore the city and make new friends. She became acquainted with some other Swedish au pairs who lived in the area and would often invite them to her loft and go out to nightclubs with them. On the evening of Friday, June the 21st, Carina and some of her Swedish friends decided to celebrate the summer solstice, which is considered to be one of the biggest holidays in Sweden since they experience around 18 hours of daylight on that date. Carina and her friends went to Zanzibar, a prominent nightclub located on Boylston Place in an area known as the Alley, which was home to a number of nightclubs and partying spots. Even though the legal drinking age in Massachusetts was 21, and Carina was just over 2 months shy of her 21st birthday, she was able to gain access to Zanzibar and purchase drinks by using a fake ID. At some point during the evening, Carina became separated from her friends and left the club, and we have a number of different accounts of what happened, which I'll get into momentarily. But no one heard from Carina over the weekend, and there was no indication that she ever returned to her loft. At around 1:30 p.m. on Sunday, June the 23rd, just under 36 hours after Carina was last seen, a homeless man started searching through a dumpster behind an apartment building located in the Back Bay neighborhood, a short distance away from the iconic baseball stadium, Fenway Park. The man was searching for cans, but accidentally ripped open a black plastic trash bag in the dumpster and was horrified to see what appeared to be a human arm inside. When the man fetched the police and they arrived at the scene, they discovered that the bag contained the dismembered upper half of a female body, and the victim was eventually identified as Carina Holmer. Her body had been sliced directly in half at the waist, and this was done in such a calculated fashion that the only bone which got cut through was Karina's spine, though a small piece of her hip was shaved off by the cutting tool. A medical disc believed to belong to a circular saw was also found in the dumpster. The top half of Karina's body had been thoroughly cleaned, and her makeup was removed, and there were no apparent bruises or defensive wounds. Since Carina had what appeared to be rope or cord marks on her neck, the medical examiner determined that her exact cause of death was strangulation before she was dismembered. However, the lower half of Carina's body was never found, so it was impossible to determine if she had been sexually assaulted. Swabs of Carina's mouth and fingernails failed to turn up any forensic evidence, though a partial fingerprint was found on the trash bag. Even though the print was run through a national database, it failed to turn up a match. The dumpster was located just under 2 miles away from the Zanzibar nightclub, and the medical examiner estimated that Carina had been alive for at least 24 hours after she was last seen there. This would have placed her approximate time of death as taking place sometime during the early morning hours of June the 23rd, meaning that she may have been held captive, but no one could pinpoint an exact location for her murder. Carina's family was informed about her death by the U.S. State Department, before her body was transported back to Sweden. Her friends and family decided to wear colorful clothing at her funeral to commemorate her joyful personality, and they also read out a poem she had once composed titled Life, in which she wrote, quote, "The richest gift you ever got was life. Don't throw that away or ever step on it, but hold it high in your hands," end quote. The Boston Police Department would launch an investigation and interview over 300 witnesses in an attempt to figure out what happened to Karina. Like I mentioned earlier, there would be a number of contradictory accounts from eyewitnesses who last saw Karina at the Zanzibar nightclub between 2 and 3 a.m. on June the 22nd. Since Karina became separated from her friends, none of them could recall having seen her leave the club, though multiple people reported that she had become heavily intoxicated, and one of the club's bouncers supposedly found Karina passed out in the bathroom shortly before closing and escorted her outside. Witnesses recalled seeing a drunk Karina in an alleyway where she was complaining about being abandoned by her friends and was unable to get back into the club. She was also seen in the alley talking, singing, and dancing with what appeared to be a homeless man, and there were reports of her walking away from the club alone on Tremont Street. However, these accounts seemed to be contradicted by a witness who happened to be the boyfriend of one of the women Karina went to the club with. He told police that he had been planning to drive Karina home, but she wound up climbing into a gray Mitsubishi being driven by two men. When the witness tried to intervene, one of the men made profane threats against him and told him to get away from the car before they drove away. As far as I can tell, this witness's story was never corroborated, though while she was inside the club, Karina did apparently tell one of her female friends that she was planning to go to an after-hours party with an older man. To add to the confusion, witnesses also reported seeing Karina between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m. that morning inside a 24-hour convenience store on Massachusetts Avenue near Haviland Street, a spot located about one block away from the dumpster where her dismembered body was eventually found. Investigators decided to check footage from Zanzibar's exterior security camera, and while the quality of the footage was very grainy, they were able to make out an image of what appeared to be Karina speaking to a burly man outside the club who appeared to be in his 40s and was accompanied by a large white dog. It turned out that Karina had been dating a Boston police officer and originally met him at Zanzibar, where he often worked paid details. While his identity was never released publicly, investigators did determine that he was not at Zanzibar and had an alibi on the night Karina was murdered, so he was never considered to be a suspect. Police also decided to put some focus on Frank Rapp and Susan Nichter, the married couple whom Karina had been working for in Dover. It was common practice for au pairs traveling to the U.S. to obtain a standard 13-month work visa through the United States Information Agency, but instead, Karina went through an unlicensed Swedish agent named Tage Sundin, who had provided Frank and Susan with au pairs in the past. So Karina arrived in the U.S. without any work visa or childcare training, and was carrying the fake ID she used to get into nightclubs while under the legal drinking age. Since Karina was technically in the country illegally and never made any contact with the Swedish consulate in Boston, she took her au pair job without working out a formal legal agreement about pay and responsibilities. Sundin had previously been fined and convicted on two separate occasions for operating without a permit, and Karina's murder compelled him to take full responsibility for her death and announced that he was planning to close his business. Karina wrote a number of letters to her friends and family in Sweden, and even though she had originally been planning to return home in August, she told them that she was going to cut her trip short because she had become homesick and did not enjoy the cleaning and housework that were part of her au pair job. But curiously, in a letter that she mailed to one of her friends in the weeks prior to her death, Karina wrote, quote, "Something terrible has happened. I'll reveal more when I get home," end quote. It does not appear that Karina revealed any specific details about the situation before she was killed, and for their part, Frank and Susan maintained that Karina always seemed happy while she was working for them and never raised any complaints. The couple told the media that they had an alibi as they spent the evening of Friday, June the 21st, going to McDonald's and a drive-in movie screening of The Hunchback of Notre Dame in order to celebrate the last day of school for their son. Frank's parents were also visiting the condo and could pretty much account for their whereabouts for the rest of the weekend. On Sunday, June the 23rd, one of Karina's friends called Frank to ask if he knew where Karina was, as no one had heard from her for a day and a half. even though Karina was not scheduled to return to his condo until Sunday evening, Frank stopped by the loft in order to see if she was there. When he could not find Karina, Frank called the police in order to report her missing, unaware that Karina's body had already been found in the dumpster by that point. A bizarre incident would take place at around 9 p.m. on the evening of June the 24th, when a fire took place in a dumpster located about 200 feet away from Frank's condominium complex. In another odd bit of timing, it turned out that on the evening of June the 22nd, Frank had visited Dover's transfer and recycling station in order to get a permit to dump there. Police performed a search of this transfer station with cadaver-sniffing dogs, but didn't find any evidence. While some burnt clothing and other items were recovered from the dumpster, they turned out to have no connection to Karina's case. Even though Susan told the media that both she and her husband had been cleared as suspects, law enforcement never publicly confirmed or denied this. The couple eventually decided to stop speaking to the police and the media and directed all questioning to their attorney. Investigators eventually did identify two of the men who had been seen speaking to Karina after she left the Zanzibar nightclub on the morning she disappeared. The man Karina had been singing and dancing with in the alley was a 31-year-old homeless panhandler named Juan Polo. Polo had an extensive criminal record, which included allegations that he once participated in a gang rape. In fact, in April of 1995, an ex-girlfriend of Polo's named Evelyn Alvarez was found dead next to a dumpster behind a bowling alley in the town of Lakeville, located over 40 miles south of Boston. She had been strangled and beaten and died of blunt force trauma to the head, and while Polo was questioned in relation to that case, he was ruled out since he had a strong alibi. Police also questioned Polo about Karina's murder, but no evidence could be found to implicate him. The man seen speaking to Karina in the club's surveillance footage was eventually identified as 49-year-old Herb Witten, who lived in the nearby town of Andover. Witten was a known character who often traveled to Boston with his 120-pound Great Pyrenees dog. He would dress both himself and his dog up in Superman costumes and stand outside nightclubs in order to attract attention and strike up conversations with women. At the time, Witten was unemployed and had a history of struggles with depression and mental illness. In fact, 1 month before Karina's murder, his sister had filed a restraining order against him after he kicked her in the foot during an argument. After Witten was identified as the man on the surveillance footage, his attorney intervened to prevent him from being formally questioned by police, as he felt that this might exacerbate his mental health issues. Witten did seem to have an alibi, as shortly after his encounter with Karina, he was pulled over by police while driving home to Andover and received a speeding ticket. However, on January the 9th, 1997, Witten's body was found inside the bathroom of his residence after he took his own life by slitting his throat. Even though Witten had never been identified as a suspect or person of interest in Karina's case, his mental health was already in a fragile state after his own father recently passed away. Witten's attorney believed that being associated with a murder investigation might have been the breaking point which caused him to become suicidal. Another individual who was looked at as a possible suspect was John McSweeney, an industrial music performer who went by the name John Zawiz and fronted a fairly popular industrial band called Sleep Chamber, who often put on controversial performances containing S&M and bondage routines. Zawiz popped up on the radar because he lived a few blocks away from the dumpster where Karina's body was found, and he was also struggling with a heroin addiction at that time. Shortly before the murder took place, Zawiz threw a party at his apartment in which he showed off some ritualistic artwork he owned, as well as a collection of human and animal bones. After the discovery of Karina's body, the mother of one of the guests who attended the party became concerned enough to contact the police. Even though Zawiz was questioned, no evidence could be found to link him to the crime. On December the 8th, 1996, Gregory Hummel, a 34-year-old real estate broker from Brookline, was arrested for attacking a 24-year-old woman he had picked up at the Zanzibar nightclub. After offering her a ride home, Hummel drove the woman to an apartment he kept in the Roxbury neighborhood, where he proceeded to punch her in the face and attempted to sexually assault her. The woman managed to grab Hummel's mobile phone and lock herself in the bathroom in order to call the police, and Hummel was subsequently arrested. It turned out that Hummel had a history of drunk driving and allegations of violence towards women, and given that he had met this victim at Zanzibar, investigators looked at him as a potential suspect in Karina's case. When he went on trial in 1998, Hummel was found guilty of his attack on the woman and received a one-year prison sentence, but no evidence could be found to link him to the murder. On May 16, 1999, a similar crime took place in Hollywood, Florida, when a 34-year-old sex worker named Delia Lorna Mendez was found inside a dumpster in the parking lot of a pet supermarket. Delia's body had been dismembered and sliced completely in half at the waist, though, unlike Karina's case, the lower half of Delia's body was also found in the dumpster. Investigators looked into possible connections between the two crimes, but ultimately concluded that they were not likely related, and Delia's murder continues to remain unsolved. It sounds like there have been no further developments in the investigation during the past two decades, so there's still no answers about who was actually responsible for the murder of Karina Holmer. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, this case has often been compared to the Black Dahlia murder, which took place in Los Angeles in 1947, and the ironic thing is that the victim of this crime, Elizabeth Short, originally hailed from Boston. And to make another parallel to Karina Holmer's case, both victims were murdered after leaving their hometowns to travel to a faraway location. But of course, given the notoriety of the Black Dahlia murder, you have to wonder why Karina Holmer's story is not more well known. I mean, it was a pretty big deal in the Boston media back when it happened in 1996, and has received fairly consistent coverage since then, but I wouldn't say that it has mainstream recognition. In a morbid turn of events, the case actually got referenced on a 2004 episode of Jeopardy, where the clue was, quote, "Boston cops were baffled by the murder of Karina Holmer, a Swede working as this French name type of domestic," and the correct response was, quote, "What is an au pair?" Obviously, one of the main reasons that the Elizabeth Short and Karina Holmer murders stand out is that both victims literally had their body sliced in half at the waist. The whole thing was done with such precision that you had to wonder if the killer was a medical professional or had an extensive knowledge of human anatomy. And of course, you get the impression that this might not have been their only crime. But a key difference between the two cases is that both halves of Elizabeth Short's body were left right out in the open for the police to find, whereas Karina Holmer's upper half was found inside a trash bag in a dumpster, and her lower half has still not been found to this day. When you think about it, it might be blind luck that Karina's torso was found at all, as it was uncovered when a homeless man accidentally cut open the trash bag while searching the dumpster. If that hadn't happened, the dumpster might have been picked up, and Karina's torso taken to a landfill, and she would still be a missing person to this day. This is why I think it's possible that the lower half of Karina's body may have been disposed of in an entirely different dumpster and picked up without anyone noticing. Theoretically, Karina's killer may not have intended for anyone to find out what happened to her. I just mentioned that when Delia Lorna Mendez's dismembered body was discovered in Florida 3 years later, there was instant speculation that the crimes might be related, since slicing someone's body in half at the waist is still a rare method of murder. But putting aside the geographical distance of 1,500 miles, there are enough dissimilarities between the two cases to feel they are not connected. In addition to both halves of Delia's body being found together inside the dumpster, the crime seemed a lot more disorganized, as her killer did not go through the trouble of cleaning her body or placing it inside a trash bag. Karina's murder definitely seemed a lot more calculated and meticulous, and since the lower half of her body was never found, we have no idea if she was sexually assaulted before she was killed, and it does not sound like there is any available DNA evidence. Nearly 2 years ago, on episode number 212 of this podcast, I covered another cold case involving young female Swedish victims, and that was the unsolved murders of Maria Lilienberg and Maria Velén, who were both killed while hitchhiking together through California in July of 1983. Like Karina, the two women had left their native Sweden in order to spend time living and working in the United States, but wound up being murdered before they could return home. I see no reason to believe there's any connection between the two cases, but these stories are truly nightmarish situations for the victims' families. How can you keep up with the investigation and spread awareness about the case when you live on an entirely different continent located thousands of miles away? Karina hailed from a small village with a population of less than 100, and I'm not sure her family has ever traveled to the United States to meet with the investigators on her case. They're pretty much in a position where they can do nothing but wait, and they haven't received any answers in 26 years. I'm sure the situation is particularly haunting, because Karina had been planning to return to Sweden earlier than usual because she was unhappy with her situation, and sent that cryptic letter to one of her friends, in which he stated that, quote-unquote, something terrible had happened, but would not provide any further details until she arrived home. So, of course, you have to wonder if this so-called terrible thing she was referring to had any relation to her murder. This is a case where a number of individuals have been looked at as possible suspects, but there's no real evidence pointing towards any of them. So for all we know, perhaps Karina was murdered by someone who has yet to pop up on the radar. It seems like there are an awful lot of weird coincidences in this story which have led the investigation in unexpected directions. For instance, you might be familiar with the story of Rafi Kodikian and David Coughlin, two friends from Boston who went on a hike in New Mexico's Carlsbad Caverns National Park in August of 1999. They wound up getting lost, and by the time they were found, Kodikian had stabbed Coughlin to death in what he described as a mercy killing since his friend was badly dehydrated and suffering so much. Nevertheless, Kodikian was still charged with second-degree murder and served 16 months in prison. Well, believe it or not, the reason this story got linked to Karina's case is because Rafi Kodikian just happened to live in the same apartment building next to the dumpster where Karina's body was found. He was even briefly questioned by police at the time, who performed a routine canvass of all the building's residents. Of course, when Kodikian got charged with another murder 3 years later, investigators checked into any possible link with Karina's case, but the whole thing turned out to be nothing more than a coincidence. So before we talk about possible suspects, we have to look at the circumstances of how Karina went missing before she was killed. We know that she was partying with friends at the Zanzibar nightclub, and apparently became quite intoxicated before she got separated from them, and her body was subsequently found in a dumpster 36 hours later. Since the medical examiner believed that Karina was alive for at least 24 hours after she was last seen, this might indicate that she was held in captivity for a prolonged period of time, and possibly even tortured before she was killed. But if so, who was responsible, and how did Karina cross paths with the perpetrator? Well, one of the most frustrating elements of this investigation is that we have a number of conflicting stories about how Karina left the nightclub. Some of them place her walking away from the club down the street while she was alone, but the version that is quite different from the others involves Karina climbing into a gray Mitsubishi with two unidentified men who yell profanities at the boyfriend of one of Karina's friends. If the account is accurate, then this suggests that multiple people were involved in the murder, but I find it odd that there don't seem to be any other witnesses who could corroborate this guy's story. That's not to say that I completely discount it, as Karina had apparently told one of her friends that she was planning to go to an after-hours party with an older man, so for all we know, one of the two individuals inside the car might have been him. Given Karina's inebriated state, I could definitely see a situation where a group of men drove her somewhere to take advantage of her, but how do things escalate to the point where these predators slice her entire body in half? I'm not sure if investigators place much credence into the witness's story, because even though he supposedly came face to face with two men who may have been complicit in Karina's murder, the authorities never released detailed descriptions or composite sketches for these guys. What further complicates this situation is that there were reported sightings of Karina at a 24-hour convenience store in the Back Bay neighborhood between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m., which would have been about an hour or two after she left the club. Yes, eyewitnesses in missing persons cases are often mistaken, but since this store was located only a block from the dumpster where Karina was found, I guess you can't discount the idea that Karina walked to this neighborhood on her own. But the issue is that the loft where Karina was staying was located in the Fort Point neighborhood in the complete opposite direction, so why would Karina be frequenting a store in this particular area? So let's start going through our gallery of potential suspects. It's been reported that Karina was dating a Boston police officer at the time of her murder, but this person's name has never been released publicly, and we know nothing about his background. All we know is that he had an alibi and was never considered to be a suspect, but of course, online discussions about this case have pushed forward conspiracy theories that the reason that this murder is still unsolved is because a police cover-up took place in order to protect this man. Well, even though there were definitely serious issues with corruption in the Boston Police Department during the 1990s, there is no evidence at all to support the cover-up theory, and I'd like to think that most cops would draw the line at protecting a fellow officer who dismembered his girlfriend by literally slicing her body in half. With the limited information I have about this policeman, I really have no reason to believe he's the killer, and I feel the same way about John Zawiz, whose link to this case is tenuous to say the least. I'm not all that familiar with Zawiz's work, but he is a prominent enough figure on the industrial music scene that he has his own Wikipedia page. The only reason he even appeared on the radar is because he lived a few blocks away from the location where Karina's body was found, and he had enough weird memorabilia in his apartment and bizarre aspects to his musical act that some people thought he might be capable of murder. But personally, I believe Zawiz almost sounds like a victim of satanic panic. He claimed that when police started questioning him about the murders, they asked him questions like, quote, "Do you worship the devil?" Of course, nothing was found to implicate Zawiz in the crime, but even though his band Sleep Chamber was reasonably popular at the time, it sounds like the combination of Zawiz's heroin addiction and him being looked at as a potential suspect in a murder caused a major downward spiral, and the band wound up going on hiatus for several years. Zawiz was able to overcome his addiction issues, and he is still alive today, and you can actually find an interview with him on YouTube from 2009 where he talks about his connection to this crime. Oddly enough, Zawiz states during the interview that Karina's boss was the one who actually murdered her, but this is not accurate at all, since no one has ever been charged with this crime, and there's no more evidence against Frank Rapp than any of the other potential suspects. So I guess now would be a good time to discuss Frank and his wife, Susan Nichter, who employed Karina as an au pair at the time, and even though they've never been named as suspects or persons of interest, you'll still find people direct suspicion towards them in online discussions about this case. Obviously, one of the biggest unanswered questions is the cryptic letter Karina sent to her friend in Sweden in which she wrote, quote, "Something terrible has happened." In letters to her own family, Karina had expressed unhappiness with her au pair job, mostly because of the workload it required, and seemed anxious to return home earlier than planned, but that one letter suggested that something much darker was taking place. While Frank and Susan always maintained that they didn't notice anything to indicate that Karina was unhappy, some online sleuths have speculated that the terrible thing Karina was referring to might have been Frank taking advantage of her. In fact, one prominent theory is that the reason Susan's body was sliced in half was to cover up the fact that she was pregnant. This doesn't necessarily mean that Frank was the culprit, as a completely different person could have gotten Karina pregnant, which would indicate that the crime was more personal, rather than Karina being murdered by a random stranger she encountered on the night she went out partying. However, I can't say I've ever put much stock into this theory, because even if a fetus had been removed from Karina's womb, I'd like to think that there still would have been medical evidence to indicate she had been pregnant at some point. After all, even though Karina had been sliced in half at the waist and the lower half of her body was missing, her torso was still intact. But getting back to Frank Rapp, I guess one of the main reasons people have speculated that something might have been going on between him and Karina is because he allowed her to spend weekends staying at his photography studio, which doubled as a loft. So theoretically, if they were having an affair, this would be an ideal place to carry it out, away from Frank's wife and children. It's also worth mentioning that Karina was technically in the country illegally while she was working as an au pair, as the family had hired her through a rather shady Swedish agency, which placed au pairs in the US without securing them a proper work visa. So if anything inappropriate was going on during Karina's employment in that household, she wouldn't have much leverage to complain to the authorities for fear of being deported. It's also worth mentioning that there were past issues in Frank and Susan's marriage, as back in January of 1991, Frank was actually charged with assault and battery against his wife, which prompted her to request a temporary restraining order against him. But a few months later, Susan asked that the charges be dropped against Frank, as she claimed his actions were the result of issues with alcoholism, and he was now undergoing treatment. She would later say that the incident was the best thing that could have happened to save their marriage, and to Frank's credit, I get the impression that he genuinely did turn things around. I see no indication that there were any more serious issues with the marriage, and if you search online, you'll see that Frank and Susan are still together to this day. It's interesting how during the early stages of the investigation, Frank and Susan told the media that they had been cleared as suspects, but law enforcement never officially confirmed or denied this, so I'm not sure if they were completely ruled out. That doesn't necessarily mean that police believed the couple were involved, as one source close to the investigation told the Boston Globe, quote, "No one's a suspect, but everyone's a suspect," which implies that they were not eliminating any possibilities. As far as Frank and Susan's alibis during the time period Karina was killed, they always maintained that on the evening of Friday, June the 21st, they took their kids to McDonald's and a drive-in movie. This wouldn't necessarily preclude them, since Karina went missing sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. on the morning of June 22nd, and her body was not found until the afternoon of June the 23rd, but it sounds like Frank's parents were visiting for the weekend and could pretty much account for the couple's whereabouts. I mean, technically, I guess Frank could have snuck out and killed Karina while the rest of his family was sleeping, but how would he have known where to find her? How can he predict that Karina would be leaving the Zanzibar nightclub at that particular time? If Frank was able to kill Karina at the loft, then that would make sense since he had access to it, but there's no indication that Karina ever made it back there after she left the club. Police even performed a search of the loft with a specially trained dog, but found no evidence to suggest that a crime had taken place there, which you would expect if it involved the victim being dismembered and sliced in half. I guess one other troubling issue which placed Frank and Susan in a suspicious light was the fire which took place in the dumpster near their condo on the night after Karina's body was found. And there's also the coincidental timing of Frank securing a permit at a nearby transfer and recycling station on the night before Karina's body was found, though Susan told the press that this was only done for the purpose of disposing of recycled newspapers since their condominium complex did not have recycling facilities. Since none of the burned materials recovered from the dumpster had any connection to Karina's case, it's certainly plausible that the whole incident was nothing more than an odd coincidence. And really, if Frank or Susan wanted to burn incriminating evidence, I'd like to think they would have been smart enough not to do so in a dumpster located so close to the residence. During a 2019 news report on the Boston radio station WGBH, Frank and Susan commented on how frustrating it is that when you type the name Frank Rapp into Google these days, many of the top matches mention him being a potential murder suspect rather than a successful photographer. Indeed, it is hard to imagine Frank committing such a brutal and horrific crime and then being able to live a normal life with his family for the next 26 years. If the couple are completely innocent of any involvement in Karina's murder, then you definitely have to feel sympathy for them, as in addition to the ensuing suspicion directed towards them, I'm sure this must have been a very traumatic event to experience. So now we'll move on and discuss three other individuals who have been looked at as potential suspects because they have connections to the Zanzibar nightclub, as two of these individuals were seen interacting with Karina after she exited the club on the night she disappeared. The first one was Juan Polo, a homeless panhandler who was seen singing and dancing with Karina in an alley while she was intoxicated, and it certainly wasn't unreasonable to suspect him since he had a criminal history and at least one rape accusation. It's been reported that Polo was questioned in relation to the murder of a former girlfriend named Evelyn Alvarez, which took place 1 year earlier. Unfortunately, other than one article published in the Boston Globe in April of 1995, I could not find any additional information about this crime, so I have no idea if it's still unsolved. But one interesting detail in that case is that Evelyn hailed from the city of Chelsea, located directly across the Mystic River from Boston, so investigators wondered if she was murdered in the Boston area before the killer drove to Lakeville to dispose of her body. Regardless, no evidence was found to suggest that Karina and Evelyn's murders might be connected. And while it does not sound like Polo was officially ruled out as a suspect in Karina's case, the fact that he was homeless and did not appear to have access to a vehicle would seem to point to him not being the killer. If Polo murdered Karina where would he have dismembered her body? And without a vehicle, how could he transport both halves of her body and dispose of them? Now, Herb Witten, our second potential suspect who spoke to Karina outside Zanzibar, he did have access to a vehicle, and the fact that he was pulled over and given a ticket for speeding later that morning does seem to give him an alibi. I can see why people might be suspicious of Witten, since he lived over 20 miles away in Andover and would drive to downtown Boston with his dog and hang outside bars and nightclubs in order to talk to women. And since he went to the trouble of dressing himself and his 120-pound dog in Superman costumes, I can see why women might be inclined to go over and chat with them. Even though there was surveillance footage of Karina chatting with Witten, this might not have any significance, as it sounds like Witten was doing this sort of thing long before his encounter with Karina, and he may have spoken to other women on that particular night. I see no indication that Witten was ever accused of being malicious or creepy towards other women while hanging out around Boylston Place, and it might just be an unfortunate coincidence that he was seen chatting with a young woman shortly before she was murdered. Now, some would argue that the speeding ticket does not completely exonerate Witten, since he possibly could have had Karina's body inside his trunk while this was taking place. Investigators have never publicly released the exact time Witten was pulled over, or confirmed if his vehicle was searched, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't, since this sounded like nothing more than a routine traffic stop. I know that it definitely raised some eyebrows when Witten decided to take his own life in January of 1997, particularly since he did so by slitting his own throat, which seems like a pretty extreme method for suicide. So did Witten kill himself out of guilt for what he did to Karina? Or did he just crack from the strain of being a potential suspect in a homicide? Well, after reading about Witten's history of struggles with depression and mental illness, I am inclined to believe it was the latter scenario. It's worth noting that even though police announced they were looking for a man with a large sheepdog who had been seen speaking with Karina outside the club, and the media later reported that this man had died by suicide, Witten's name was never released publicly until weeks after his death. Witten's attorney also prevented him from being formally questioned by police, as he felt that Witten could not mentally handle an interrogation. But even though Witten was never named as a suspect or person of interest, it sounds like just being associated with this crime in any fashion took a toll on his already fragile mental health, and may have been the breaking point which drove him to suicide. And you also have to couple this in with the fact that Witten's own father had recently passed away, and it sounds like he took his death pretty hard. It was not until the lead detective on the case, Thomas O'Leary, was asked about Witten in the June 23, 1998 edition of the Boston Herald when he publicly stated, quote, he didn't do it. Indeed, one reason why it's hard to imagine Witten being the killer is because he had a history of erratic behavior, but Karina's murder was a meticulous, organized crime, and it's hard to imagine Witten, or Juan Polo for that matter, being able to commit a murder like this without leaving any evidence behind. So our final potential suspect is Gregory Hummel, who was not seen with Karina at Zanzibar around the time she was killed, but made the news 6 months later when he picked up another young woman from that same nightclub and proceeded to take her back to his apartment and attempted to rape her. She managed to grab Hummel's mobile phone and lock herself in the bathroom to call for help, but if this hadn't happened, could she have potentially suffered the same fate as Karina? While Hummel did have a history of allegations of violence against women, there's still a big difference between beating and sexually assaulting them, and murder and dismemberment. I was unable to find much follow-up on the investigation into Hummel, only that he spent a year in jail for his attack on the other woman. And incidentally, if you search through the Boston Globe's archives, you'll find Hummel's name listed multiple times in the real estate transactions section for selling houses during the mid-2000s, so it does not sound like his jail stint curtailed his real estate career. But even though Hummel violently attacked a woman he picked up at Zanzibar, I'm not sure if he could be placed at that same club on the night Karina was there, so for all we know, perhaps investigators were able to establish he had an alibi and ruled him out. However, the one thing which might point away from Hummel, Polo, Witten, Frank Rapp, or any of the other known potential suspects is the partial fingerprint which was found on the trash bag containing Karina's body. While this has never been publicly confirmed, I'd like to think that investigators at least attempted to compare the print to the fingerprints of all these other individuals I just mentioned, and found them not to be a match. So this is why I'm inclined to believe that the perpetrator might be someone who has never been investigated or shown up on the police's radar. It's hard to imagine someone going to the trouble of slicing a woman's body in half and never committing another crime like that, but then again, after 75 years, we've still never conclusively determined who was responsible for the Black Dahlia murder. So for all we know, Elizabeth Short's killer may have gone back to living a normal life and never committed any other murders. The whole crime is such an anomaly because we don't know of any similar murders which took place in the Boston area during that time period. So did the killer move elsewhere, or change their MO, or did they just simply never kill again? We have to harken back to Karina's cryptic letter about something terrible having happened, because while the whole thing might be nothing more than a red herring, it could also hold the key to this mystery. But until then, we can only speculate, and since this is a cold case which may not be solved through DNA profiling, it might require the right person coming forward with information. So if you happen to know anything about the unsolved murder of Karina Holmer, please contact the Boston Police Department Unsolved Homicide Unit at 617-343-4470. That's 617-343-4470. Or if you want to send in any tips anonymously, please call the Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-494-TIPS. That's 1-800-494-8477. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Anil Adyanthaya for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, like I mentioned in the intro, our podcast is going to be releasing another Q&A episode near the end of the year, so if you would like to send me any questions to be answered on the show, please email them to me under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is Sunday, December the 11th. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special Halloween-themed bonus episode about the infamous Falcon Lake incident, where a man named Stephen Michalak supposedly came across a UFO inside a provincial park in Manitoba, which caused him to receive some unexplained burns on his body. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1991 murder of Soo-ya Kim. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ashley P. and BJ. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶